Hello, everyone. This is Andy Smerik of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Thanks for being with us this week. Now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a woman who's getting ready to deliver her healthcare speech to a joint session of Congress tonight, the lovely and fabulous Stafford Palmieri.
It was great until you stumbled over my first name. Hi, Andy.
So that's one speech, but what about this other speech the president gave yesterday?
I feel distinctly more socialist today than I did yesterday.
I know, I do too. And now we have all these kids who are going to be budding socialists walking all around the country
what
today.
What are we going to do?
Egad. So certainly that got a lot of play in the press over the past week or 10 days and so forth. And I think we're going to chat a little bit about that later on when Mickey comes in. So that's what we have on tap. So Mickey's going to do Rate That Reform, taking your place since you've moved up to the major leagues, got called up here at the end of the season. We also, of course, are going to play Pardon the Gadfly first with our intern, Jack Byers, who's making his rookie debut here on the Gadfly Show. You excited, Jack?
Oh, yeah.
Ah, fantastic. And so, of course, we have Amber, who's going to be here later to do the research minute, and we'll be timing her, of course. But until then, let's get started. Jack, you want to kick us off with Pardon the Gadfly?
A disproportionate number of New York City schools received A's and B's on their report cards for 2008-2009. Not only is this a huge increase from the year before, but some of the schools with high marks are listed as persistently dangerous under No Child Left Behind. Should we celebrate or be suspicious?
Suspicious.
Why so?
Well, almost all of the schools that, or actually all of the schools that failed last year got A's and B's this year. These grades are based on a state test that we have talked about in previous podcast shows and also in the Gadfly that have gotten easier. And it just seems completely fanciful to think that all of these schools could have made this kind of progress in 1 year. So it just means that the grading metric needs to be recalibrated. And in the meantime, all of these teachers are getting bonuses on grades that may or may not mean anything, which is, you know, great. Performance pay can, you know, has its benefits. But when performance pay is based on things that are not
trustworthy,
or on grades that are not based on grades that are trustworthy, then we've got to wonder.
Yeah, so I think there are actually two different things that we have to piece out here and think about separately. So the first one is the state assessment itself. Is it tough enough? Is it changing? And are they lowering the cut scores? And so there's been a lot of debate about that. So just the general metric being used, is it getting easier? So are scores going up even if kids are staying the same in terms of their levels of proficiency? So that's something there's been a lot of discussion about that. But the second issue actually has to do with what New York City does with those test scores and how it evaluates the schools to decide if they're an A school, a B school, C school. So not to get too much in the weeds, but what the city does is it actually averages and takes a look at a school's scores over a three-year span, and then if you take a jump up in this last year compared to how you did in the past 2 years, you're going to get a higher grade.
Right.
So because there was a big jump in student test scores all across the state, especially in New York this last year, when you compare that to the two previous years, all these schools look good. So two different things have to be looked at. Is a state test reliable? And then how is New York City actually deciding who's an A, who's a B, who's a C, and so forth? My general sense is I'm still a fan of assessments. I think they do good work, and we need to take a look at some of these questions. But I just worry that this is one more thing that people are going to pile on and say, oh, we can't trust any assessments. Let's go back to the drawing board and do something different.
See, Andy, I'm disappointed. Last time when we had this conversation about the New York test specifically,
yes,
you said we should be celebrating. Why do we always have to be suspicious about tests? Maybe these kids really have made gains.
Well,
have you done a 180 on us, Andy?
Well, I would prefer if you wouldn't throw my previous statements back in my face, because that holds me accountable. I think the fact is, when you, what was it, 97% of schools in New York City got an A or a B, so 97% of schools are excellent or very good. Probably not. But once you start to look at these actual metrics, it becomes a more interesting story. There was a New York Times article that actually showed the bell curve moving to the right, and I'd actually encourage people to take a look at some of these articles and some of the graphics, because it does give you a sense that there is a distribution in quality of schools. It's not just they're all excellent, it's just that the distribution is now largely just between A, B, and a little bit in the C range. All right, we've beat that horse. Jack, what's next?
In a new program to curb school violence, Chicago has figured out the identities of the 1,200 students who are most likely to be shot. They plan to give these teens extra support through social services, a personal advocate, and finding them after-school employment to keep them off the street. What should we make of this complicated statistical figuring?
Well, it's certainly jarring anytime a superintendent of a big school system says, I have a good idea, the next 200 students are going to get shot. So once you get past that, and if you trust statistics, and we should if we're rigorous people, it's interesting that they actually did some regression analysis and they took a look at a bunch of different demographic statistics and different characteristics of students in schools and neighborhoods, and they actually have an idea of who kids, which kids are going to be the most likely to get in different types of trouble, including violence trouble. So if we can get over the shock of saying that we know which kids are going to get shot, and I think in the case of Chicago, 300 kids were shot last year, and something like 50 or 60 of them actually died. So this is a serious issue. So I have nothing wrong with getting rigorous about figuring out which kids are in danger, whether the panoply of interventions the superintendent has in mind are the right ones, a completely different story, but I'm all for using good numbers to figure out which kids are in danger.
I think that actually the most interesting thing about this is that we could use this kind of statistical figuring to figure out other characteristics about students that may or may not be related more to achievement. So find out, you know, this 1,500 students most likely to not be proficient this year, and use this kind of statistical figuring to target those students. So I think it's very interesting that Chicago has taken a more math-based approach to this.
Issue number three.
Boston and New York have seen the average age of their principals steadily decrease in the last 10 years. Some are worried these 35-year-old youngsters are too inexperienced and will burn out after a few years. Others claim the fresh young blood will do wonders for schools. Who should we believe?
What do you think, Stafford?
I'm going to support the 35-year-old youngsters.
I believe it. Because you're, what, the ripe age of 18, 19?
Very fun. I think that this whole idea that you have to be of a certain age, have to have certain experiences, have to have certain credentials to do a good job is not true, and it has not served the school system well. And obviously, I don't think you should hire people just because they happen to be 35, but I don't think age really should be a factor that's weighted very heavily, because this should be a meritocracy, and that would be a better system for schools, instead of saying, well, you don't have your master's in administrative science, et cetera, et cetera, and that being criteria.
Well, we can chat with Amber about this when she gets here, about the way that age and experience plays into some of the research we have on whether or not it makes for a good teacher. But I think the fact of the matter is, my reading of this is, just because you have a 5-year teacher, a 10-year, 15-year, 20-year teacher, that doesn't mean you're going to know which is better than the other one. I think the same thing goes with principals.
Yep.
The truth of the matter is, there are highly successful people who are 25 and launch Google and Facebook, and I think Thomas Jefferson was in his early 30s when he crafted the Declaration of Independence, and on and on and on. So young people can be highly talented. Look at Dasha Toll of Achievement First and Mike Feinberg and on and on. But just because you're young, the other side of this coin, doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be great at what you do. So it's not necessarily the case that being young is going to solve all of our problems. So I don't much care how old they are. Let's just figure out how good they are.
Well said.
Excellent. All right. Well, I guess I win. Do you get any awards here? All right. Well, I think we've done enough here. So now it's time to move on. I think we're going to go next to Amber. Is that right?
Yes.
She is here with the Research Minute.
With the Research Minute. Oh, I like it. It's louder this week. Hear it.
So Mike told me that I have to take off my watch and stare.
I know,
and
he's such a stickler about
stare
that.
Stare at it ominously while you read.
Drives me crazy. So I bring such value added to the show, and yet he keeps me to my 60 seconds.
And yes. Energy.
Especially because we, you know, always stick to our 90-second part of the gadfly rule.
Right.
Yeah, I think we do. Terrible.
I know.
So tell us, what do you have this week?
I have another public opinion survey this week. It is Phi Delta Kappa's 41st annual Gallup poll of the public's attitude toward public schools. So one of the key findings is the same one that shows up every year, namely that Americans give their local schools high marks, but not public schools nationally. Half also don't think that NCLB has helped schools, though two-thirds favor a national mandate for an annual test in grades 3 through 8. Approval of charter schools continues to rise. Two-thirds of Americans support charters, but very few actually know what they are. Roughly 75% of Americans also support merit pay for teachers, and about the same percentage think student performance on standardized tests should inform it. Finally, and this is a bit disturbing, Americans rank intelligence as the third most important personal quality in a teacher, behind dedication and caring about students. But perhaps this is good news, since intelligence was ranked eighth in importance when the survey was administered roughly 25 years ago.
Oh my.
Dun da da, how'd I do?
Well, I think you buried the lead there. That's actually the one of the most interesting things. So say that again, 25 years ago.
So 25 years ago, intelligence was ranked eighth in importance, and now it's ranked third in importance behind dedication and caring.
All right, so actually brief us up, first of all, on what does the research tell us about how important a teacher's SAT scores or...
Very important. SAT, GRE, you know, all those things. Verbal ability is the number one, you know, predictive, you know, characteristic of whether a teacher's going to do well. And as you just pointed out a second ago, experience, you know, we've known from really solid research after 5 years, you know, a teacher's value added pretty much flattens out. You're not going to get that much more out of that person after 5 years. So
but you improve from pretty much your first year to your fifth year.
Right.
And then after that, it's going to be
right,
flat.
Then you're flattening out. But so, you know, I mean, clearly Americans are looking at different things than, you know, researchers are looking at and care about different things, which we know that to be true. You know, parents care more about school safety sometimes than, you know, standardized achievement scores and whatnot. So this is not surprising, but, you know, perhaps good news that, you know, they think intelligent teachers are perhaps a little bit more important than they used to.
Well, what I find interesting is this exact point, because I think it was back in 2003 or 2004 when I was working for the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. We did the first survey to figure out what the American population knew about charter schools. And the biggest shock to me at that point, and I think this was early 2004, was that something like 47% of the population admitted knowing next to nothing or very little about charter schools. And it's gotten a little bit better, but it's still probably in the 30s right now, I think, with the last one of the last studies I saw from the Alliance. So I guess more people are more knowledgeable, or there's some people who have gotten more knowledgeable, but there's still this big swath of America that has no idea that these are public schools, no idea that they serve all kids, that many of them, most of them are in low-income urban areas. So we got some education to do.
And yet, according to
still support it,
PBK
right.
and Gallup, 64% of them support charter schools. So, I don't know. This made me actually think of the EdNext survey about the Obama effect. That it sounds like people believe in the brand name of charters, but they don't really understand what they are, which makes you wonder what's going to happen when the brand name gets tainted by, I mean, Obama's popularity is on on a downward spiral right now.
That's true.
Right. Well, hopefully he won't sink other things along with it himself.
Well, I know these charter school advocates have been trying to brand charters in a certain way for several years, and I don't think it has worked yet, but we'll see. So actually, let's get to the most important part of the research minute, the music.
Well, since many Americans are not overly concerned with the intelligence of teachers, we have Stupid Girl by Garbage.
Wow. Good choice of song.
It's Laura.
So are you a Garbage fan?
Oh, you know it.
Are you?
Yeah,
of course.
Right.
I mean, it's a little bit of a throwback.
I have never heard of them, but I have heard of this song.
Oh my. So Laura, that was your doing? You found this?
Wow.
All right. Thank you, Amber, as always. Great job. So now we have Mickey, who's going to come in and rate that reform taking... Oh. Da-da-da-da-da-da. How are you doing, Mickey?
I'm doing pretty well.
So you were going to talk about this story that just about no one knows about that was completely missed. This apparently the president gave a speech about education to school children yesterday.
Yeah, it was a major under the radar kind of thing. I'm not sure why people missed it. People were so kind of engaging on the healthcare debate that
I try to follow education news, and I think I just missed this one.
Yeah.
All right, so brief us up. What happened?
Okay. So everybody knows, of course, that Obama gave his big back-to-school speech yesterday, and the speech itself, I think by most accounts, was straightforward, not terribly controversial, not political, not partisan. But the lesson plans that the Department of Education came up to accompany them were the ones that really got people fussed up, in particular the parts where students were asked to write down stuff like what they could do to help the president, what about that speech particularly inspired them. And so I took a minute this week to actually look over the lesson plans for grades 7 through 12, and I want to give my rating for that one. So my major problem with the lessons plans is they're not actually lesson plans. The title given to them is, quote, menu of classroom activities. They're not actually designed to teach anything. Instead, they're just kind of a series of activities and exercises. For example, you get the listening with purpose exercise, where students write down important words and then organize them into, you know, the ubiquitous concept web. Then there's, you know, at the end of it, there's this goals making exercise where, you know, students write about their academic goals for the year and plot out what steps they're going to take to achieve them, which is, you know, great. But creating and meeting goals is actually really hard. And the activity kind of tends to trivialize them. Mm-hmm. You know, you just put them on a little index card and, you know, they make it sound like it's really simple. So, you know, the department has made teacher quality a major kind of focus of its reform efforts. And these lesson plans were actually made up by these kind of star teachers who are now doing this year-long fellowship at the Department of Education as teaching ambassadors.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in light of the department's focus on teacher quality, I think that I would really have liked to have seen a real lesson plan, a real kind of model civics lesson that, you know, actually incorporated some kind of interesting content themes about the role of the president. Why does the president address the country? How is that related to his kind of legislative agenda? Who are some other, what are some other, you know, examples of great or poor communicators, and how did that relate to their presidency? Something of that sort, you know, a real solid lesson that Arne Duncan could proudly say, this is the type of model teaching that we want to be doing in our country.
All right, so I'm going to push back on that in a second, but okay. Do you have a grade for this thing?
Oh, sorry, yeah, C minus.
C minus, okay, because you wanted it to be a little bit more thorough, fleshed out.
Yeah, I didn't think that this menu of activities actually accomplished anything whatsoever.
So the reason why they did it that way, I'm 99% sure, is that there are actually federal rules against the U.S. government, the Department of Education, getting into the business of lesson plans, getting in the business of telling schools what to do. This just harkens back to the principle over ages and ages and ages that local governments, local boards ought to control schools and not federal bureaucrats. So I think the fact that they called them this menu of options as opposed to lesson plan was probably purposeful. But that, of course, is where they got into all the trouble, that this entire speech hullabaloo wouldn't have happened, I think, I am pretty sure to say, had they not done this, had they not added this additional piece of what can you do to help the president. It looked like the president was going to indoctrinate, or the department was going to indoctrinate by asking kids, what can you do to help the regime? That's when all this stuff blew up. And for what it's worth, the second half of the speech, I think, is superb. Absolutely excellent. When he talks about not only hard work but perseverance, not giving up when things get tough, the importance of realizing that no one is good at everything at the beginning and you have to keep pushing and pushing and pushing. This is exactly what kids need to hear, and if they hear it from the president, all the better. I just think it's a mistake the way they went about it. And the other thing that bothers me, and I want to hear what Stafford thinks about this, is the controversy that erupted. A lot of people think it was illegitimate, but there are actually really good questions. Should the president talk to kids? If the president is going to talk to kids, what should he say? Should the Department of Education put together lesson plans? These are legitimate questions that need to be discussed. So when the Secretary of Education calls all of the concerns silly, or when the press secretary of the White House says that this is just a food fight and that conservatives were doing this for nefarious reasons, I think it belittles the idea that people actually have a real stake in whether or not the government ought to be the president should be talking to kids and what he ought to talk to them about. So put me in the camp of saying that I think this was a worthwhile conversation to have. It got too heated, but the president's speech was excellent. Stafford, what do you think?
My first reaction to the lesson plans was how Obama-centric they were. As far as I know, God did not die and promote Obama. And I'm kind of sick and tired of hearing about Obama's messiah-likeness, that he can inspire people to great heights. And I realize that he is a president that is in a position that no other president before him can be in, especially inspiring inner city children. But at the same time, to sort of play off that and have these questions like, you know, how did the president inspire me and what can I do to help the president, is just so self-aggrandizing that it's frankly kind of repulsive.
To be fair though, I think there was just one bit in the 7 through 12 lesson plan about being inspired. And there was one bit in the pre-K through 6 about, you know, what I can do to help the president. And those two clips are the ones that, yeah, you know, kind of generate all this. And the rest of it, they don't mention the president directly. It's much more this kind of activities for how to, you know, write down important words. What were the themes of the speech, you know, that kind of stuff.
So I think that we should, as a team here, decide that we're going to put a moratorium from this point on in talking about the speech. I think we and other people have completely
killed
this thing. Enough is enough.
here.
So I
bury
just
the hatchet.
Bury the hatchet. Let's move on to other things. Thanks for being with us. Until next time.
I'm Stafford Palmieri.
And I'm Andy Smerick for the Education Gadfly Show. Bye-bye.